Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. 40 Minutes in the Old Testament is a 1517 podcast network podcast. You can go over to 1517.org/podcast, see all the podcasts that are existing over there together as one, in one accord, as it were, to spread the gospel of Jesus Christ to as many people as possible, in as many ways as possible, particularly in this way, podcasting. You might be like, I want to be a part of that. I want to help do that. Well, you can. It's real easy. In this season, as we are coming upon, where 'tis more blessed to give than receive, and since you've been receiving all them podcasts all year long, you could give back. You could. You can go over to the support page on Christ Hold Fast or on 1517, and you can become a supporter. Every little bit helps, and we can keep this thing rolling. Chad, it is a shocking thing. We're not going to talk about numbers here, but over the last few months, the podcast has really picked up some steam. You know, I mean, not that we didn't have some steam before. I mean, I thought we were rolling right along. I was already sort of shocked by how many people listen to this. It is surprising. There's one iTunes review that says, don't waste your time, a very long and boring 40 minutes. That's kind of how I feel like most people would react to this podcast or listen to me and you talk about the Old Testament for 40 minutes. I'm surprised that 80% of the reviews aren't like that, but they're not. There's a whole bunch of other people that seem to like it. And that over the last few months, the podcast numbers have literally doubled. And so I don't know what happened, but people are jumping on board, taking this. I mean, I guess it's just numbers.
Yeah, that's it. That's it. Numbers is pulling people in. Everybody wants to learn about numbers.
Everyone wants to learn about numbers. And so that's the only thing we can come up with. But in all seriousness, it is fairly humbling when we look at it and see how many people are jumping on and joining us every week. It's a weird thing, Chad.
Yeah, well, the more the merrier. We're glad to have everybody on board.
Absolutely, absolutely. So this week, we're going to talk about some rebellion.
yeah, unusual, huh? Yeah. Old Testament, rebellion. What a strange combination.
Yeah, you'd think at this point people would be like, this is getting a little redundant.
Yeah, yes. Haven't we heard this story like three times already? Yeah, that's pretty much... pretty much my impression too. And we're not finished yet. For those of you who think this might be like the climactic rebellion, finally Israel will rebel and learn their lesson. Well, no, not exactly, because we still have a long ways to go. Although I think it will, we've only got a few left. We're kind of on the downhill slide of the rebellions, at least in their current geographical situation in the wilderness. Of course, Israel, if it's known for anything throughout the history of the Old Testament, it is actually rebellion. Doesn't matter whether they're in the wilderness or in the promised land, this will continue. Until, of course, we get to the New Testament, when everybody finally learns their lessons and there no longer are any rebellions. Everybody lives in peace and churches are never divided over any kind of conflict whatsoever.
That'll be a good day.
Yeah, that'd be a good day. We'll wait for the last day for that to happen. Yeah, so we are at the beginning of number 16, and it's kind of a long chapter, long story, a lot going on, a lot of people involved, a lot of grumbling, a lot of accusations, and as we'll see, a lot of death. So if you're into grumbling, accusations, and death, you're really going to enjoy this particular podcast. So number 16 follows on the heels of our discussion of some really unrelated material, I guess you could say. There was talk in chapter 15 about various kinds of sacrifices. We talked about sins of defiance, those where you are kind of lifting your hand, fighting against God, as it were, by your rebellious acts. And then we finished off chapter 15 with a discussion of a seemingly unrelated, completely unrelated discussion of tassels on garments, and the color purple and blue, and what that has to do with the priesthood and the royal nature of Israel. So we're going to jump right into something completely different with the beginning of chapter 16. And we're introduced to some characters here that actually come up quite a bit in the rest of the Old Testament, and even make an appearance one time at least in the New Testament, in that very short one chapter book called Jude, the second to the last or the next to last book of the New Testament, where Jude actually makes reference to Korah, who's one of the guys we're going to meet in number 16. So Korah is he's the one who is associated with this particular rebellion, although he is by no means the only one who is in trouble here. He also has some cohorts, and we're introduced to a couple of them right away. So we have Korah, who is a Levite, but we also have Dathan and Abiram, or Abiram, or however you want to say his name. I don't know how most people say that in English, but I usually say Dathan and Abiram, who are from the tribe of Reuben. So we got a couple of different tribes with individuals from those tribes that are involved in this particular uprising. And they all have kind of a different role to play in this Israelite tragedy. But Korah is usually fingered as the ringleader of this particular rebellion. So it starts out by listing these guys' names and what tribe they're from. And it follows in verse 2 by saying they rose up before Moses together with some of the sons of Israel, 250 leaders of the congregation. So this is not just three or four guys who have an issue with Moses and with Aaron, but this is a sizable number of people. And as the story progresses, we see that it also has a snowball effect because more and more people get involved in this particular uprising. Now, you got to keep in mind kind of the historical context of what's going on here, because this is not very long after they had to turn back from the Promised Land. So just a couple of episodes ago, we heard the story of how they left Egypt, they spend a year at Mount Sinai, they make the journey to the Promised Land, they're on the edge, the spies come back with a bad report about the land, that yeah, it's a great land, but the people there are so big, they'll squash us like a bug. And so the people weep and wail and feel sorry for themselves, and God ends up almost destroying them. But instead, he sentences them to 40 years in the wilderness, where all the adults 20 years old and up will perish in the wilderness, and their younger sons and daughters are going to enter the Promised Land instead of them. So this follows very rapidly on the heels of that particular story. So you can understand from a psychological point of view, if you will, where the people are at, where their heads are. You know, they're upset. This is one of those cases where we see this a lot, where people are mad at God, but really they're mad at themselves. They just don't want to admit it because they have no one to blame for the situation that they're in except themselves. God wasn't to blame. Moses wasn't to blame. Aaron wasn't to blame. It was the people themselves who were to blame for their predicament. But rather than confessing that and accepting the consequences and dealing with it and bearing their cross, instead, they get angry at God and they deflect their own guilt upward toward him and do the old Adam trick and blaming God and blaming other people. So in this particular case, Moses and Aaron are the main ones they blame, but God is also supposedly at fault in the eyes of these people. So here's what happens. So we get the stage set. We know the actors, Moses and Aaron, of course, but also Korah and Dathan and Abiram. Korah the Levite, Dathan and Abiram the Reubenites. Here's what they did, verse 3. So they get together, they assemble themselves against Moses and Aaron, and I love the way this opens up. You have gone far enough, they say. And it follows, not only have they gone far enough? Well, here's what their accusation is. For all the congregation are holy, every one of them, and the Lord is in their midst. So why do you exalt yourselves above the assembly of the Lord? So this kind of sets the tone for the rest of the chapter. Why do Moses and Aaron exalt themselves above everybody else? Because in this particular argument, everybody's holy. The Lord is in our midst. So why does Moses And why does Aaron, why do they have the leadership over the Israelites instead of somebody else? And the somebody else in this case, of course, is Korah and Dathan and Abiram and the 250 others who have joined with them. So we'll unpack that some more, but let's first hear how Moses responds. Well, first of all, he responds physically. We've seen him do this before. He falls on his face. I don't know exactly how to interpret that, because there's different ways, there's different motivations for someone falling on their face. Someone can fall on their face just in awe of the presence of God. They can fall on their face in prayer, in mourning, or in intercession. So we're not exactly told what was going on in Moses' mind. Maybe it was a combination of two or three of those reasons, but that is how he reacts physically. He falls on his face, and then he responds. He speaks to Korah and to his company. He says, "Tomorrow morning, the Lord will show who is his and who is holy, and will bring him near to himself. Even the one whom he will choose, he will bring near to himself." So Moses first responds that way, verbally, and then he's gonna put forward the test by which the Lord will show who is his and who he has chosen. He says, verse 6, "Do this: take censers for yourselves," the censers, that in which incense is burnt, "take censers for yourselves, Korah and all your company, and put fire in them, and lay incense upon them in the presence of the Lord tomorrow. And the man whom the Lord chooses shall be the one who is holy." And then he uses their own words against them. So they said to him, "You've gone far enough, Moses." And so Moses finishes off his response to them by quoting their own words against them. He says, "You have gone far enough, you sons of Levi." So this is a this is a pretty fascinating story on multiple levels here. I've been thinking about it quite a bit actually over the last couple of weeks in preparation for this chapter, and I've come up with a couple of different takeaways from it, because I'm trying to think of this story not just in this particular context, but also kind of as a representation of what often happens when there's trouble in the assembly of the Lord, whether that is here or in other places in Scripture or in the church today. So it'd be interesting your take on this, Dan, too. But it seems to me that part of what's going on here is an argument basically over control, over who's in charge.
Yeah, absolutely. I feel like whether it's in the church or whether it's in other places, when someone steps up and says, "What, you know, why do you get to lead? What makes you better than all the rest of us?" They're never saying we should all be equals. I mean, they might actually say that, but what they're doing is they're putting themselves forward as someone who's
as a better leader.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, it's that he has rounded up these guys. I mean, you become this usurper of authority, right? Now, the way that you do this usually is you get everybody else to agree with you that this guy's not that great. You use the language of we're all just as good as him, but what you mean is I would be better than him. And what they're thinking is you would be better than him because you're the guy that's telling us that we're just as good as him. And so when it comes time to have a new leader, we'll agree with the guy who said that we're just as good as the old leader.
So it's a very political move.
Absolutely, yeah. That this happens no matter what. This is like trying to be like a populist candidate. Mm-hmm. You know, I do think that Moses falling on the ground, I think this is just Moses knowing how this is going to turn out. I think the mourning is right. I think he's bummed out because I don't think there's any question. I mean, you could see how quickly he responds. I don't think there's any doubt in Moses' mind that this is not going to go well, and he's tired of seeing his people rebel, and these are his people, you know, and he knows that this is going to be just another instance that goes badly. There are many times in the Moses narrative we see his frustration, But we also see his intercession for the people. So he has this duality going on all the time, it seems, where he is interceding for the people. He loves the people. He doesn't want to see the people destroyed. He wants to see them obtain the promises of God. And at the same time, is very frustrated. I mean, he will strike the rock a couple times. He doesn't know how to do this. And, I mean, who can blame him? So he's got people that he loves that he's extremely frustrated with. And so in this moment, I think you see both of those things come out, where he falls on his face, which I think is out of sorrow and knowing that this is going to end badly. But at the same time, throwing this back in their face and saying, no, you've gone too far. And we'll see how God responds to this. It's not going to be good.
Yeah. The one consistency about Moses that you see throughout all these stories is he never wants the innocent, or at least the not as guilty, to be punished. You see that consistently in his interactions. So, for instance, here he's going to get very angry. Down in verse 15, it says he becomes very angry in response to what Dathan and Abiram had to say. And other times he gets angry as well. But he never gets so angry that he's like, you know what, God, you're right, just destroy everybody and let's start over. Or, yeah, just lump everybody together, the guilty with the not as guilty. I won't say the guilty and the innocent, the guilty and the not as guilty, and let's just wipe them all out. He is consistent in his demand for an equitable justice. And he wants justice to prevail. And he's not, we'll see it in this particular case, he's not in some way opposed to God punishing the guilty, but he certainly is opposed to God just putting everybody together into one group and destroying them all and starting over. So yeah, he consistently is on the Lord's side, interceding before the Lord for the Israelites, and then also in some cases wanting the guilty to be punished. And we'll see that very explicitly in this particular case. I think another thing that's going on here before we move on with the story itself is kind of it's a difference that I like to make between power and authority. You can have someone with power who's leading whatever the group might be, or you can have someone with authority. In this particular case, Moses and Aaron, they have authority because authority is when you are fulfilling the will of the one who has called you or hired you or put you in the position that you're in. So it's not your own will that you are imposing upon other people. You're doing the will of someone else. So that's what it means to be in authority. It means someone is above you. The word author is embedded in the word authority. So the authority always goes back to the author. In this particular case, in the biblical narrative, the author, capital A, is always God. So he's the one who gives any authority for those whom he's called to speak and to act on his behalf. So they don't do their own will. They're doing the author's will, and that's why they have authority. So God has called them. God's called Moses. He's called Aaron. He's called the priest to do their thing. And he's even called the Levites to do their thing. But all these things are different. Everybody has different duties in their various vocations. And what Korah in particular, as a Levite, is trying to do is to say, hey, we're Levites, but we can do the work of the priesthood. Well, actually, no, you can't, because that authority has not been given to you. Other authority has, but not that particular authority. So there's authority, then there's power, and power is nothing but the imposition of one's will upon someone else. So I think that's what Korah is after here. He's after power. He wants to be the powerful leader of the Israelites because he thinks that he can do a much better job than Moses and Aaron have done, because they have, in his view, screwed up everything. Whereas actually the Israelites as a group, especially the adults, they're the ones who have placed themselves in the situation that they're in. And power is not going to solve anything. We'll see later on in Israel's history what powerful leaders do, those who just impose their own will, and it's always ends badly. So I think that's going on here too, and I think that's that's the same thing that happens in a lot of churches today too, happened throughout history, this struggle between power and authority. Power is the old Adam trying to impose his will upon others, and authority is something, is a completely different kind of animal.
Yeah, I think one of the reasons that Moses gets questioned all the time and has to deal with this all the time is that you see Moses as someone who leads with humility. I mean, we've read that he is described as a very humble person. So you don't see Moses sort of exercise power a whole lot. He does lead in a very humble way, in an intercessory way, and that opens you up to somebody else to say, like, this guy's weak. I mean, he doesn't demand respect or anything like that. He's not leading with power. And so then somebody who is power hungry will come along and look at that type of leader and say, like, well, that's not a powerful person. And if you see someone who is not powerful, then you think that that's someone that you can overthrow. The problem, for Korah is, while Moses might be a humble leader, he does have somebody fairly powerful behind him that has called him to lead him that way. And in one sense, you also see that Korah is going to fight the law. I mean, Moses represents the law, and as he goes to try to fight with the law, which is, this is your role, this is your role, this is how this should be done, this is how what Moses represents, you will see that you can't usurp it. You can't fight the law and win. Doesn't
There's
work.
even a song about that.
Yeah, there's even a song about it. You can't
I
you,
fought
you
the law
try
on the law, boy.
That's
Yeah,
right.
every time.
Yeah. So that's how this goes. But I think it's a good point though, the difference between power and authority. And Moses certainly has authority because someone with absolute power has given it to him. And this is the thing that Moses knows. I mean, the reason he's both sad and angry is that he knows who God is going to choose. He knows what God has already said. He knows that God is not going to side with Korah. That God doesn't all of a sudden become wishy-washy in his and how he wants to get this done. And so Moses knows that this thing is, I think that Moses knows immediately that this is over before it starts.
And I can't help but feel some compassion for Moses, because it wasn't like he sought this particular job. He
Right.
was
No, he resisted it pretty
pretty
hard.
content in his retirement as an 80-year-old shepherding sheep in the wilderness when he happened upon the burning bush and God told him to go and deliver his people Israel. And of course, he didn't do the whole Isaiah thing. Oh yeah, here am I, send me, send me. He was like, no, send somebody else. Send anybody. Send my brother Aaron, but just don't send me. So he did not seek this particular position of authority. He was called into it, placed into it, and he's doing his best to lead the people. So what happens? Well, to pick up the story here, Moses is going to respond to Korah, and basically in verses eight and following, he says, look, the Lord has given you Korah and your brother Levites, he's given you the Levitical service. So why are you seeking the priesthood too? And why have you rebelled against the Lord and sought what he has not given? So he responds to them, and then he also he sends a summons to the other guys, to Dathan and Abiram, and he tells them to come up, to come out, because they need to get this settled. But they basically want to stay home and sit around and pout because their situation is not what they wanted it to be. And we have an amazing statement. This just like jumps off the page at you. Verse 13. So they're responding to Moses, and they say, no, we're not coming up. Verse 13. Is it not enough? They're speaking to Moses. Is it not enough that you have brought us up out of a land flowing with milk and honey to have us die in the wilderness, but you would also lord it over us? Now, you talk about a slap in the face. So God has promised them time and time again that he's going to bring them into a land flowing with milk and honey. That was the whole purpose of bringing them out of Egypt, to get them through the wilderness and into this milk and honey land. They turn everything around And in their anger and frustration and self-pity, they say to Moses that Moses has brought them up out of a land flowing with milk and honey, which of course is a reference to Egypt. So they've just completely turned everything around. So he's not, according to them, not only has Moses strong-armed them out of this perfect land flowing with milk and honey, namely Egypt, but he also was trying to lord it over them along the way. Now, this is just insane. This is insanity right here, that they are describing the place of captivity, of hard labor, where their newborn sons were drowned in the River Nile, where all this horrible, terrible things happened to them, as a land flowing with milk and honey, as if it was Eden itself, and Moses came in and forced them out of this just splendid situation they were in to bring them out into the wilderness. And not only that, but now he's being he's lording it over them as well. So it's just crazy.
Yeah, and they also are throwing his words back at him, because before that, in my translation, you have Moses say to the sons of Levi, "Is it too small a thing for you that God has separated you, to minister to the people in the tabernacle, right?" And then they turn around and say, "Is it a small thing that you have brought us out of paradise to kill us in the wilderness?"
Yeah. everybody's using each other's words against them, right? Right.
Yeah, and you're right. I mean, it's absolutely insane. So Moses saying, like, "Hey, it's just a really small thing that God delivered you from slavery, and then separated you to minister to the congregation in the work of the tabernacle." And they're like, "Small thing." You know, it's not a small thing. Is that that's not slavery. That was straight up paradise. It was flowing with milk. I mean, that is absolutely nuts that's what they think of. This is like what happens when the game of telephone has just went completely sideways, because somehow Egypt has developed this reputation over time of being awesome, and it's not awesome. So in their minds, they have bought into this lie that slavery was good. And this is exactly what we do. We start believing this lie that life apart from God and sin is great, and that God's holding out on you, and it was so much better if he just leave you alone, unless you have all the things that you used to have. And you have this weird amnesia that just does not make any sense. That's just crazy.
That's some crazy psychology right there. that's what goes on in the twisted and corrupted human mind and heart. And as you point out, it's nothing new under the sun, because that's the same thing that we still do today. I mean, we can think back to the good old days of sin and captivity and idealize it and forget about the fact that, yeah, we were dead. We were in bondage. We were heading for condemnation. And in some way, we idealize it and pretend as if it was the land flowing with milk and honey. It's a strange phenomenon of the human condition, that when our current situation is not going the way we want it to go, like when we're in a wilderness and things aren't going our way, all of a sudden the past, we become nostalgic for the past and all the supposed good things that were there. Whereas if we could actually go back in time and experience it, we'd realize that it sucked, that it was awful, that we didn't have the peace, we didn't have the forgiveness, we didn't have the life and salvation, all the things that we have now in Christ. But so it goes for sinner saints, right? So what happens? Picking up here with verse 15 and going on the rest of the story, I want to make sure we finish this in the time that we have. Well, this is the verse 15 is where Moses, as I mentioned earlier, gets angry. And he gets angry and he talks to God. He says, "Don't regard their offerings." I assume he's talking about don't regard their offerings from that they're about to give, the incense offerings. Then he has this strange, "We don't speak this way." But Moses makes a point of saying that I have not taken a single donkey from them, nor have I done any harm to them. I guess we would say, you know, I haven't received a single gift from them. And not only has that not happened, but I haven't done any harm to them whatsoever. In other words, this is Moses' way of saying he's innocent. He hasn't taken any gifts or bribes or turned things around and harmed them in some way. He's just been doing his job. He's been trying to do what God has called him to do. And all the people do in response is to rebel against him. So he responds first to God, and then he turns around and he responds to Korah, and he lays out what's going to happen. All right, so Korah and all the guys who are with you. So you think that you can be in the priesthood, and you think that just because every one of you is holy and that the Lord is in your midst, that you should be able to do whatever Aaron and his sons do. Okay, well, I'll tell you what, let's have a contest. Here's what we're going to do. We'll find out for sure what the Lord's will is. Everybody's going to get their censer and put some coals on it and put some incense on it. And we're going to gather here at the doorway of the tent of meeting, and we're going to see what God has to say. So that's what happens. And the glory of the Lord appears to all the congregation. All the people are like, I mean, this is a big thing. So you got all these people kind of gathering around to see what's going to go down. And the Lord responds in verse 20 by saying, hey, they better get back. Separate yourselves from this congregation that I may consume them instantly. So once again, at the threat of annihilation, Moses stands in the breach, verse 22. And he says, O God, the God of the spirits of all flesh, when one man sins, will you be angry with the entire congregation? So we've seen this is at least the third or fourth time where God is threatened to wipe out everybody. And Moses says, no, that's not just. That's not the way you are. Just because Korah sins doesn't mean that you wipe out the entire body of Israel. So the Lord, we kind of have this back and forth. So God says to Moses, all right, tell everybody to get back. Get away from the tents of Korah and from the tents of Dathan and Abiram, because what's about to happen is something that they don't want to be close to. So that's what Moses does. Verse 26 and following, he says to the congregation of the Israelites, he says, get away from the tents of those wicked men. In fact, don't even touch anything that belongs to them, lest you be swept away in all their sins. And so everybody, verse 27, everybody starts backing up because they know something's about to happen. So the congregation backs up from these tents, and Dathan and Abiram, they come out with their wives and their children, and they stand there at their tents. Remember, they wouldn't come up to see Moses. They stayed home. They stayed in their tents. And so Moses says, verse 28, that this is the way that you're going to know that the Lord, you're going to know 100% sure that the Lord has sent me to do everything that I've been doing, and that this isn't my prerogative, this isn't my will, this isn't my plan that I'm somehow fulfilling. Verse 28, he says, here's the deal. If these guys, if all these people die in an ordinary way, I mean, if they die like basically like everybody else is dying, then the Lord hasn't sent me. But literally in the Hebrew, verse 30, if the Lord creates a new thing, if the Lord does something entirely new, and what is this new thing? The ground opening up and swallowing them, and they go down alive to Sheol. If that happens, then you will understand that it's these men who have spurned the Lord. And the words are barely out of his mouth.
Yeah, this seems reasonable. Like, all right. If this insane thing happens, you know.
Yeah, it ought to be pretty clear at that point, right?
Yeah, I remember growing up all the time, people would be like, God is doing a new thing, but they never quoted this particular verse.
Yeah, I don't know why this one never is quoted. It's right there. He's going to do a new thing. So the new thing happens to Dathan and Abiram and to everybody who's with them. That's exactly what happened. I mean, as soon as Moses finished speaking, the ground opens up, splits open. It's like an earthquake. Earth opens its mouth and swallowed them up and their households and all the men who belonged to Korah with their possessions, so that they and all that belonged to them went down alive to Sheol. And then the earth closed up over them, and they perished from the midst of the assembly. So this is like the picture of the earth has a mouth, and it just opens up, swallows them, and then just like we do when we swallow, we close our mouth, and then, bam, they're gone.
It's pretty swift.
You don't think that made a statement. Yeah. So that happens to them, and then we got that happening, but there's also something else happening. The 250 men who had the fire pans, it said that fire came forth from the Lord and consumed them. So we got two different kind of consumptions going on here. The earth consumes some of them, and fire consumes the rest of them. Just like we saw way back in Leviticus chapter 10, when Nadab and Abihu, the sons of Aaron, they offered strange fire before the Lord and were incinerated. Same thing happens with these 250 guys. And just to kind of wrap up the story, what happens after that is they gather up all the fire pans, all the censers of the men, and they melt them down, they beat them flat, and they make a bronze plate for the altar as a reminder to the sons of Israel of what had just happened, that these Levites who tried to usurp the priesthood were rebelling against the Lord. That's not the end of the chapter, but that we'll wrap up the end of the chapter next time. You know, this whole story, I was thinking about how close it was in many ways, at least thematically, to what happens in the New Testament with when Christ comes as the new priest, as the new leader, as the one who is constantly in conflict with the priest and the Pharisees and the scribes of the day. You kind of have, not exactly, but you kind of have the same thing going on here too. I mean, it's a question of who is the priest that God has chosen, right? Who's the priest that he has called and that is going to bring us into the presence of the Lord? And of course, for the Christians, that's the great high priest in the order of Melchizedek, Jesus himself. And yet you have rebelling against him, even rebelling to the point of putting him to death, the other priesthood, the established priesthood, who wanted to bring the people of Israel close to him in their own way and not in the Lord's way. Except in that particular case, it was that great high priest who himself was destroyed, who died. And that very act of atonement was the means by which, in God's ironic, backwards sort of way, he actually brought about forgiveness for all the rebels and atonement for all the sinners and the priesthood of Christ.
Yeah, and instead of the ground splitting in two and swallowing everyone up, the veil is torn and an entrance is made possible. It's a very backwards thing that happens with Christ.
Yeah, it's not the same as number 16, but it's God's way of kind of turning everything around and making everything right in the new priesthood of Christ.
Yeah, and you know, of course, you know, it's now that this insane thing has happened, they have learned.
Yeah, never will Israel rebel again.
I mean, they've got the reminder. They got the plate reminder. I mean, what could go wrong now?
What could go wrong? Well, I guess we'll have to find out next 40 minutes.
I guess we will. All right, guys, thanks for joining us. We will be back next week.
See you then.